Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, February 23rd, welcome, 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 friends. On Into the Program, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So on Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court kneecapped a major chunk of President Donald Trump's tariff program, ruling that the president overstepped his executive authority by using IEEPA, a decades-old emergency law that never even mentions tariffs. The decision knocked out about half of the president's tariffs, and he reacted pretty strongly, immediately blasting the conservative justices who voted to overturn the measure and arguing that America's enemies are celebrating. The president soon imposed an across-the-board 10% tariff under another law and upped it to 15% over the weekend. Countries are now wondering what the new tariff means for agreements already reached and business owners who pay tens of thousands, millions, or even billions of dollars in tariffs are wondering if they can get that money back. And of course, consumers wonder whether this will mean cheaper priced goods. So today on Studio 2, we're digging into what this ruling actually does, what it means for executive power, and what's next for prices, trade, and the economy. We've got a legal scholar lined up for the first part of our discussion. Then we'll turn to the economic impact with a Financial Times columnist. And of course, we want to hear from you, our listeners. We'd love to get your reaction. And our question of the day is, do you think the Supreme Court's break with Trump signals a larger check on presidential power? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, hello, hope you're warm at home. You can leave your comments in the chat.
Yeah, curious if folks think this is just a one-off or maybe the beginning of a trend when it comes to how the high court treats President Trump. And of course, on the economic side, it's a big tear in his economic strategy. It'll be interesting to see how he riffs from here.
Yeah, definitely interesting. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And we have our trio of news stories. And the big story, everybody talking about it. We're looking around if you're outside.
It snowed, y'all.
There it is.
Obviously, if you were in a dark room and you hadn't opened up the windows yet, you might not have known, so now you do. It snowed. Mm-hmm. As of 7 a.m., Philadelphia had picked up 13.7 inches of snow. Folks in South Jersey saw even more. Mm. West of the city, not so much, but still a major storm. As of Monday morning, about 73,000 folks without power, almost all of those in South Jersey. SEPTA bus service had been suspended, but good news is they're starting to restore that bus service. The storm is close to over, but still plenty of digging out to do. And Philly trash pickup, speaking of digging out, is suspended until Wednesday. Now, here's the good news, because I know you need some.
We need some, please.
This should melt fairly quickly. We have a lot of days coming up with highs above the freezing mark starting on Wednesday. The bad news could be a minor snowstorm on Thursday night. We'll see. We'll see. But minor and quick, hopefully. And maybe it won't even happen. By the way, Cherry Gregg didn't think this snowstorm was going to happen.
Out me, because we had a little office pool going on, and I was like, this is not going to happen.
Back up. What happened was we were talking about how we're going to get into the office today, strategizing, and you just chimed in on your own and said, don't worry, it's not going to happen. It's too warm. And I said, want to bet?
And I was like, yes. 2 inches or less.
And that was, let me just ask as a follow-up, are you always anti-science or just when it comes to the weather?
I was for
hating on the meteorologist.
I know, this one time I was in denial, and now I realize denial is, in Africa, it's more than a river in Africa. That was my bad. I did go to the grocery store with all the other panic buyers, but because I wasn't 100% sure, and I didn't want to be hungry this morning and said, whoa. But basically, I've been trolled since about an hour into the snowstorm. So. And Avi, by the way, when you said he won,
I said 11 inches, so I was still low.
But
I was the highest among everyone in our group.
The producers
were like down with you. I'm like, what's going on? Are you guys watching the forecast?
I didn't believe it.
You guys think they're lying?
It was gorgeous on, it was a wonderful, but I think, you know, what I thought was gorgeous on Saturday was because we were under this freeze for so long.
Right.
So yeah, I was clearly wrong. Just very wrong.
Cherry Greg versus Big Weather. Big Weather wins round one.
Story number two. New Jersey Democrats are hoping to send a message with a new proposed bill that would expand the residents' rights to sue immigration officials. The bill is called the Fight Unlawful Conduct and Keep Individuals and Communities Empowered Act. The acronym, if you didn't catch on, is F-U-C-K-I-C-E. Clearly, that scene sends a message, right? I know the look.
Yeah,
right.
I can't really say much for FCC reasons. So
yeah, we'll leave it there.
We'll leave it
FCC there. FCC ICE. There you go. There's not a lot of details available for the bill. I went on the website. Not a lot there. But
the details might not be the point here.
Yeah, that's not the point. But what it appears to allow is expanded authority for New Jersey residents, including immigrants, to file civil claims against federal immigration officials under New Jersey state law. This bill, of course, is a part of a broader effort in New Jersey to protect immigrant residents, including proposals that would bar law enforcement, including ICE officials, from wearing masks, as well as impose a 50% state tariff on privately run migrant detention centers. Other states have also introduced similar bills, but of course they're not named in such
a colorful way.
By
the way, I do feel like this is a trend, giving bills names that will get attention. So I did a little digging, and I actually found, this is a little old now, but there was a data journalist named Noah Veltman who looked at acts of Congress from 1973 to 2013. And he looked specifically for bills that had acronym titles. Okay. In the 70s and 80s, it was basically unheard of. In the mid 90s, it started to pick up from 95 to 2005. And then from 2005 to 2013, the incidence rate just exploded. And I was like, I'm curious what happened then. And the first thing I thought was, it's the beginning of the social media age. The social medialization of politics, the sort of the coarsening of discourse on some level, but also needing to get attention quickly with something very snappy at the top. That's just my personal theory, but it does feel like it is a trend. And by the way, there's been an Apple Juice Act in Congress, a Babe Ruth Act in Congress.
Love it.
Some guy tried to make a bill to get rid of acronyms in acts, and he called it the Acronym Act.
All right. And I wonder what how you read that. That was some long
accountability and congressional responsibility on naming your motions act.
Interesting.
So I do. It's an interesting.
I wonder if there's somebody who has that job.
Exactly.
Has that job.
Yeah, some low level staffer, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Give me five options for different acronyms. But also, I think it speaks to, I think sort of like maybe as well, the fact that proposing a bill is maybe as important as passing a bill now. Mm-hmm. And like, not as many bills are passed. So just like getting some attention for what your bill is actually called might be more important to legislators now.
Yeah. Interesting. The sponsor said the bill's attention grabbing name should not obscure its serious intent. They said it's a serious bill, but
I wonder if it obscures it or not.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing I wonder about is effectiveness here. Mm-hmm. But anyways, conversation for another day.
Real quick,
before we get to our main show today, story number three, the Winter Olympics closed yesterday, as you probably know. Team USA beat Team Canada in a thrilling men's hockey final. Afterward, USA. Team USA honored former South Jersey hockey star and NHL standout Johnny Gaudreau by raising his jersey aloft and inviting his young children onto the ice. A truly touching moment missed it. Yeah. You'll recall Gaudreau and his brother were killed by an alleged drunk driver in 2024 while bicycling in South Jersey. Gaudreau would have likely been on Team USA had he not passed away. He was a standout player for the Americans in junior tournaments. Unfortunately, NHL players were not allowed to compete in the Olympics in 2022 or 2018, so Johnny Gaudreau never got a chance to fulfill his lifelong dream of playing in the Olympic Games, and so the team this year decided to honor him.
Yeah, I read this was, for the team, the first time they won a gold in decades.
Yeah, since 1980.
So that's a pretty big deal. But what a lovely tribute for a New Jersey resident hockey hero who lost his life in such a tragic way. I also want to take a moment to shout out the U.S. women's hockey team.
Yeah.
Also earned a gold medal.
Dramatic gold as well.
Yeah, overtime game against Canada. It's the team's third gold medal. And
tough Olympics for Canadian hockey.
Yeah, and got to say, since it's Black History Month, got to mention Layla Jones Edwards, the first black woman to ever play on the U.S. women's hockey team.
Nice.
She was part of this team, so pretty cool.
What's your favorite Olympic memory, Cherry Gregg?
All
the time you spent not watching it?
I know. But
I don't really watch the Winter Olympics either, I'll be honest. I love summer so much. Winter just doesn't do it for me.
Yeah.
Because I didn't grow up playing icy sports, you know what I mean? All the sports seem so foreign to me.
Yeah.
The Olympics, summer Olympics, you're like, yeah, I get it. Track and field, basketball, I'm there.
I get it. Yeah, I was falling asleep every night to curling. My husband was watching the U.S. curling team. They didn't medal, but, you know, it was nice to rest in that.
I would try curling.
I could see you doing that.
Yeah. I like bocce. Anyways, we'll be right back. This is Studio 2.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. In the past year, President Trump has levied sweeping global tariffs in an effort to revive American manufacturing. He's also used tariffs as a cudgel against foreign powers like China, who he claims have ripped off Americans for decades. But on Friday, the Supreme Court ruled that President Trump overstepped his executive authority, rendering over half of his tariffs imposed unconstitutional and unlawful.
Democrats and some Republican lawmakers celebrated the decision, including Nebraska Representative Don Bacon, who had this to say.
While the Constitution was defended today, the checks and balances of the branches of government, I thought Neil Gorsuch wrote a brilliant ruling. It's really conservative philosophy that he espoused. I mean, Milton Friedman and Adam Smith and the founders and what they intended. And he made it clear, any tariff has to be approved by Congress.
But on Saturday, Trump vowed to levy a 15% tariff worldwide and derided the justices. Take a listen.
The Supreme Court's ruling on tariffs is deeply disappointing. And I'm ashamed of certain members of the court, absolutely ashamed for not having the courage to do what's right for our country.
So today we're asking, if the SCOTUS ruling won't deter tariffs in the long run, what impact will this decision ultimately have? And what does the conservative court's break with the Trump administration reveal about the limits of executive power at a time when many see it as expanding? Joining us now is Kate Shaw, professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania and co-host of the podcast Strict Scrutiny. Kate Shaw, welcome back to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Yes, and to you, our listeners, we'd love to get your reaction and thoughts. Our question of the day is, do you think the Supreme Court's break with Trump signals a larger check on presidential power? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can put your comments in the live chat.
MJ says, I think it's too little too late. We're doomed. Kate Shaw, maybe we'll start there. Do you think this is a too little too late check on executive authority? Do you think it's significant? If you were kind of putting us somewhere on that spectrum, where would you land?
So I think, Avi, it is a significant ruling. This is the first big merits ruling. So a ruling where the justices got briefs, they heard oral arguments, they drafted lengthy opinions, and there are concurrences and dissents. And it is a resounding loss for President Trump. And I don't think that we should understate that. But I also think that the commenter is right, that it comes on the heels of over a year of kind of facilitation of outsized assertions of executive authority by this Supreme Court. Now, that's primarily happened on the shadow docket. So these emergency applications that the Trump administration has filed with the Supreme Court, often where it is lost in some significant way in the lower courts. And the Supreme Court again and again has sided with the president and handed him, in many instances, new authorities. So that is the important, I think, backdrop to this opinion. But it is a big loss for the president on what is in some ways his signature policy issue, tariffs. He cares a lot about tariffs, and he lost big here.
As a quick follow-up, what do you think made this case different for the justices? And obviously, it's being decided in a different way. It's not on the emergency docket, but there must have been something in the law, something in the way that a couple of these conservative justices think about the law that was different about this case than some of the prior ones. What do you think that was?
So I think there are a couple of possibilities. One is that here the justices actually took the time to carefully read and parse the statute, that 1977 IEEPA statute that you referenced up front, that hands the president, you know, significant authority to regulate in the face of what the statute describes as these significant emergencies. The explicit language is the president has the authority to deal with any unusual and extraordinary threat, which has its source in whole or substantial part outside of the United States to the national security, foreign policy, or economy. So that's the language of the statute. And the court took a close look and said, it's not obvious that both that language and later language in the statute that lists these particular powers the president has, and on that list is conspicuously not the power to impose tariffs. And the court basically said, reading all of the statutory language in context, it doesn't look like the president has this power. And I'm not sure the court did that kind of careful analysis in these many other cases on the emergency docket where it has sided with the president. So
The difference is they just took the time to read the statutes?
Yeah. Maybe. I have long been a critic of what the court is doing on the shadow docket, and that is in part because they are moving so swiftly and often in these very high stakes contexts, and they are just oftentimes not even writing an opinion explaining their reasoning and just handing a win to the president. So that is one possibility, different procedure. But I also think one possibility, and this is, I think, a more cynical one, is that here the stakes to kind of the market, by which I mean both the U.S. Stock market and kind of global markets, was so significant that the justices in some ways were saving both the economy and the president from himself. And there was, I think, a cross pressure here because this is a conservative majority that is very enthusiastic about executive power, but also kind of protective of conservative economic principles. And in this case, you had a lot of conservative voices on the other side from the president urging the court to strike down these tariffs. So I think that cross pressure may explain the different outcome in this case versus other cases.
And we just heard that clip sort of setting up this conversation from conservative congressmen out of Nebraska talking about those conservative principles. But, Kate, I want to talk to you because 6-3 was the ruling. This was definitely a majority. You had Roberts, Barrett, and Gorsuch breaking from their conservative colleagues to make this decision. Were there any major legal principles that they used that you think would be applicable in some of the other cases where the president definitely expanded his executive authority?
So I think that's a really important question, Sherry. And I think that we'll see in the next case if the court is as willing to rein in executive overreach as it was here, if we're in, say, the immigration context, right? Because that's where I think a lot of future kind of showdowns over executive power in the Supreme Court are going to arise. So you had both the three Democratic appointees and then the three Republican appointees that you just mentioned, the Chief Justice Roberts and then Gorsuch and Barrett, together voting against President Trump for kind of different reasons. The Democratic appointees basically said, well, the statute that I was just describing just doesn't give the president the authority he is claiming. And the three conservative justices in the majority agreed with that reading of the statute, but also said there is this idea, the major questions doctrine, that says that Congress has to be really explicit if it's going to give the president or an executive agency really big, broad authority that's going to have significant economic and political effects. And this statute just wasn't clear enough to hand that kind of power to the president. And that is a doctrine that I think could well throw into question some of the president's more aggressive moves on things like immigration, on his decisions to refuse to spend funds, to cancel hundreds of millions of dollars in grants. I mean, many of the big, bold executive actions the president has taken, I think, are somewhat suspect under the major questions doctrine. And I think it remains to be seen whether the justices will use that same principle against the president in other cases.
And my quick follow-up to you on this is, do you take anything from the justices that separated themselves? Does this sort of create a new kind of coalition, a new kind of break in this, you know, this six majority conservative justices? And then I also, in doing that, Gorsuch seemed to chastise both the liberals and his conservative colleagues when we talk about the major questions doctrine. So just sort of, does this three conservative sort of breaking apart, will this be a trend in your mind? Do you think it sets something up for the future?
I think it's a very interesting kind of developing dynamic. So you're right about the Gorsuch concurrence. So he was very, very hard on both his fellow conservatives who voted in favor of President Trump here because they voted against President Biden's exercise of executive authority in a bunch of cases. And he was also critical of his Democratic appointee allies in the majority who voted against President Trump here, but had voted for President Biden's exercise of executive authority in cases like the big student loan cancellation case that the court invalidated under President Biden. And I think that Gorsuch has some reasonable points, but I also think the Democratic appointees have a very compelling story to tell about actually the kind of principled consistency. Sometimes statutes do give the president some powers. Yeah. They thought they did in the student loan case, and they just thought the statute didn't do that here.
Mm. Lobster C3K on YouTube says Congress needs to take back the power of the purse. Congress's role is supposed to be the power of the purse. Martin has a comment that's really in line with something that you said earlier, Cade. Though I was encouraged by the decision, I don't think it signals that SCOTUS is planning on pumping the brakes on presidential power. They've been complicit in expanding his powers because of the so-called unitary executive theory, which is consistent with the GOP's embrace of a strong branch and a limp legislative branch. SCOTUS only checked Trump because it impacted their wallets. Like, this is the very cynical reading here, right? Mm. That this is just like, well, let's find some reason in the law to pump the brakes here because we don't agree with his economic theory. Let me put that aside for a second, though, and go back to this whole major questions doctrine. Because frankly, as a layperson, I'm reading about it and I just don't get it. Like, is the idea that we're just going to defer to the president unless the thing impacts something big and we're the ones that decide whether the thing impacted is big? I think about legal tests all the time, and this one seems so strange to me. Can you explain it from both sides here, Kate, just so I can understand it a little bit more?
Sure. And I think, Avi, you're not alone in finding this a puzzling doctrine. I think the Democratic appointees agree. I think, you know, as a law professor, I, too, find it difficult to really explain the major questions doctrine, because I think I am very sympathetic to what Elena Kagan has said about the doctrine, which is she calls it the made up major questions doctrine. She says this is something that the majority has invented and invented quite recently to wield as a cudgel against executive action that it disapproves of. And that has primarily been by Democratic presidents. But of course, we see it can be wielded against Republican presidents here, too. But it's a pretty recent doctrine. The court only actually used the phrase for the first time less than 5 years ago, although it has its origins in cases that go back about a dozen years and maybe in one case to the year 2000. But, you know, this is not a kind of a storied doctrine that has a long history. It's something that is pretty new. And I think, Javi, what you said about, well, who decides if something like what the majorness of an executive action is?
Is this a big deal or not? That's what it sounds
that is
like
just
to me.
Wildly subjective, and it does feel like it's about kind of the vibes of whatever it is the executive
vibes.
Is trying to do, whether it's an agency.
But Gorsuch
or the
must have said something more than it's just the vibes. Like, they
must be trying
to stake out some definition. I mean, are they trying to stake out some definition here?
So, yes. And they say that this is a principle that is grounded in these core constitutional values of the separation of powers, where Congress has the legislative power and the president has executive power. And Congress is supposed to be in the driver's seat making the big policy decisions that kind of govern all of our lives. And the president does the implementation, but doesn't make the big policy choices. Now, that might sound a little surprising to people who've been paying attention for the last year and in some ways in recent decades, because we have seen the ascent of a very powerful president, and especially in the last last year of a kind of unilateralist president. But it, by design, says Gorsuch, it's really Congress that's supposed to be playing that role. And Congress can hand some authority to the president, but there are limits on how much and how. And the major question doctrine is just kind of a way of policing those limits to make sure that Congress makes the important policy choices, doesn't just sort of pass the buck to the president to do that.
Yeah, and that's been a big complaint about this Congress. And so I want to zoom out a bit because now the president immediately has pivoted and says he has the authority to wield these tariffs using other laws. And I want you to kind of explain to us where these what other alternatives the president claims he has to wield these tariffs and whether or not you think they will be upheld by a court.
Sure. So as you said at the beginning, this is, you know, this is a ruling that was really about this one 1977 statute, IEEPA. But there are lots of other statutes Congress has passed that give the president certain kinds of powers to impose certain kinds of tariffs. And immediately in the wake of this decision, he announced that he would be imposing first a 10% and then he quickly upped it to 15% kind of across the board tariff at under a provision that's called Section 122 of the Trade Act of 1974 that gives the president the power to impose tariffs of up to 15% for a limited period, so only 5 months, 150 days, to address, quote, fundamental international payments problems. Mm-hmm. Not totally clear what that means, sort of about these kind of trade imbalances, but this is probably going to be litigated. People are going to argue that the president hasn't made the showing to justify invoking this particular provision. And then there are a couple of other provisions that he has suggested he might also invoke, one called Section 301, one called Section 232, each of which requires certain findings to be made by federal agencies before the president can actually impose those tariffs. And I expect the groundwork in those agencies is happening right now. But there, too, I think that people who are troubled by, you know, and have are kind of injured in their pocketbooks by these tariffs are now going to be emboldened by this opinion, and rightly so, to think that, well, just because the president announces a tariff, that doesn't mean he has the legal authority to do that. And so there will be challenges, I think, to all of them.
Yeah. And then the other big thing is, will they get their money back? Because right. I've heard that the head of the U.S. Treasury has said that this will be a question for the courts, that the Trump administration has no intention of putting together any type of structure to allow for refunds. Your thoughts on that? And I mean, there it seems like there might be some lawsuits, or are there mechanisms in the law to allow people to get their money back without having to sue? Mm.
So I think there probably will be many lawsuits. So right. So we're talking about, you know, between $100 and $200 billion worth of refunds that could be at issue. And one very striking aspect of the majority or the Supreme Court opinion on Friday was that it didn't say really a word about how these refunds were to be handled. So that's entirely punted to the lower courts and I think to kind of private one-off litigation. I do think that if the Trump administration is not going to affirmatively facilitate the refunds, then it's going to probably fall to the courts and litigation, which of course really disadvantages small players who might not be able to kind of lawyer up and march into court to get their refunds. That doesn't mean a court might not be able to take a lawsuit brought by some impacted parties and try to create a mechanism for refunds to be sought by others, even if they're not immediately, you know, coming to the court, right? That's what things like class actions are for. Mm-hmm. But kind of there are mechanisms for kind of tariff-specific refunds that the courts have used before, never at the kind of scope and scale that we're looking at here. But I do think that this is going to probably be a long process where it could be months, if not years, before people see these refunds.
Oh, my goodness.
I want to read this comment from Jane, who's hearkening back to a prior Supreme Court decision in this comment. The Supreme Court's 6-3 decision giving the president immunity from prosecution for official actions lands hugely on the side of our institutions not holding. You don't have to be a constitutional scholar to know that decision is extremely harmful. We are a nation of laws, and the president is not above those laws. We talked about vibes earlier, Kate Shaw. Let's get this sort of a vibes-based question. But after this decision, do you feel like the checks and balances system, however one defines that, is kind of holding, or some shell of it is holding? Yeah. Or does it still feel as weak today as it felt prior to Friday?
I think that's a great question. I feel better about the kind of strength and durability of our separation of powers today than Thursday before the opinion was issued. I agree that Trump versus United States, the opinion handing even before he was reelected, yep. So this is a July 2024 opinion, handing presidents enormous sweeping new immunities from criminal prosecution, but also broad immunities from legislation or even judicial oversight, really threw our separation of powers badly out of whack, and we are continuing to live with those effects. But I think that this opinion is an important reminder that the court did not intend to say the president fully and formally stands above and outside of the law and the Constitution. The rules that give the president some powers but not all powers do continue to apply. And I think this court majority was both talking about the tariff power but maybe trying to make a broader point about the presidency being constrained by law, even with this broad immunity that was announced in Trump versus United States. So I think I feel cautiously optimistic that this means the court is at least sometimes going to be willing to stand up to outsized assertions of presidential power, in particular where those are inconsistent with statutes and the Constitution. But I don't think that anyone should basically say, well, this suggests that the majority of the Supreme Court is no longer going to ratify all of these broad assertions of presidential power and instead is going to act as a meaningful check. I think it's way too soon to say something quite that sweeping.
Mm. Yeah, we only have a minute left, Kate, but I wonder whether or not this ruling, in your mind, puts pressure on the president to work with Congress because his tariffs are very uncertain now. And the court clearly says that is a power left to Congress. Yeah. Your thoughts on whether this is a pressure point for the executive?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's been a striking feature of this presidency, just how unilateralist the president has been, even while controlling both houses of Congress and not really seeking legislative authority to do many of the things that he could easily do if Congress gave him that authority. Instead, he is overreaching under existing statutes and the Constitution. And I think that one easy fix would be for the president to go to Congress. And the court would likely be fine with much of what the president wants to do if he had legislative authority to do that. I think that's unlikely to happen. And so I think that if the court is fairly reading the Constitution, it's likely to deal the president more defeats. Mm.
Well, that's the perspective of Kate Shaw, law professor at the University of Pennsylvania and co-host of the podcast Strict Scrutiny. We always love having you on the show, yeah. Kate. Welcome back anytime. Thanks for being here on Studio 2.
Thank you, Avi and Cherry.
Yes. And after the break, we're talking to a Financial Times columnist about the economic implications of this latest Supreme Court decision. We'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. We'll be right back after the break. This is Studio 2.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. This hour, we've been digging into the Supreme Court's decision Friday that many of President Trump's tariffs are illegal. Now we want to turn to the economic impact of that ruling.
Trump has already said he will levy a 15% global tariff in retaliation. But this is still a setback to a key priority of his economic platform. He's often called tariffs the most beautiful word in the dictionary. Meanwhile, the federal government has collected $133 billion in tariff revenue since they went into effect. So how will businesses be refunded, if at all, and what about consumers? The tax was often passed on to us in the form of higher prices. Will we get any relief?
Helping us sort through all of these questions is Rana Faruhar, global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times. Rana, welcome to Studio 2. So great to have you.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and we want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere. Do you think the Supreme Court's break with Trump signals a larger check on presidential power? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you could drop the comment in the chat. David Began on YouTube says, "We live in a global economy. It is strange that a capitalist economy would want to tinker with businesses' pricing." And so, Rana, we wanted to kind of start this part of the conversation by getting reaction. What have you heard from the business community, whether it be large companies, small businesses, and global corporations? What are they saying in reaction to this ruling?
So it's a great question. C-suites everywhere, big companies, CEOs, their boards are all in their war rooms right now. They're going back to the calculations that they had made really beginning in Trump 1 about this changing paradigm. Just to kind of go back and set the stage, I mean, until Trump came in the first term, we'd been in a period where for about a half a century, tariffs were going only down, and they were pretty low. I mean, they were about average 3% in the U.S., higher in Europe and much higher in China and other parts of Asia. We saw a major turnback from that. This administration has been a major turnback from that. Big companies had done pretty well thus far because they have the technology, the lawyers, all the money really to optimize their supply chains. And so I'd been hearing prior to this ruling from big companies that, you know what, 15% tariffs, we can do it. We can make it work. We're not going to have to pass on too much cost to consumers. Small and mid-sized businesses, totally different story. You saw many of them already, even before this ruling, beginning to go out of business. Now, what this ruling has done is it's thrown more chaos into an already chaotic situation, and it's increased litigation. You're already seeing environmental groups, public groups, corporate groups beginning to sue over trying to get back some of the tariff money. You're going to see years of litigation, and we haven't even gotten into how our adversaries and allies are going to respond. Different countries are looking at this. They're saying, you know, maybe Trump doesn't have the leverage that he thought he did. Maybe this means we can play tougher hardball with the U.S. So it's a mess, in short. And big companies will do better than smaller and mid-sized ones. But I think even big companies are looking at this and saying, wow, we got a long, slow slog ahead of us.
Yeah.
Joseph from Mount Airy says these tariffs were a shame to begin with. They are harming us as Americans. By the way, if you just want to add your 2 cents on the tariffs in general, give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. But getting back to Joseph's comment, Joseph said they are harming us as Americans. Mm-hmm. I mean, from Liberation Day till now, Rana, what do you think the impacts of tariffs were on the American economy as a whole compared to expectations?
So let me back up and say that unlike some progressives, I actually thought that tariffs could be used as one very strategic tool in an economic arsenal to deal with non-market practices, to deal with, say, Chinese mercantilism or monopoly power in certain supply chains. But what Trump did on Liberation Day is completely nullify, really, the effects of tariffs by putting them on both adversaries and allies alike. Imagine that, you know, you've got a country like China, for example, that you can make a great case that they have monopolized the supply chain in certain areas unfairly, or they have lower environmental standards or labor standards, and, you know, we should adjust our own trade system to account for that. But when you say, I'm going to slap tariffs on the EU, I'm going to slap them on Canada, some of our greatest allies, you're just confusing the world. You're making it clear that policy is being made at the level of the White House in a way that feels very arbitrary, as opposed to a broader, you know, more congressional consensus around this kind of policy shift. So I think what Trump did was lay down a line in the sand where the rest of the world realized, gosh, the U.S. is no longer a reliable partner. It doesn't really matter whether we're your friend or foe. You might get hit with a tariff. Mm.
And I wonder, like, who won and who lost here? Because there's a lot of folks who sort of capitulated to President Donald Trump. They negotiated early. They wanted to lower their tariff costs. And then there's China and some other countries who got the heavy duty tariffs. And now they're winning big with major cuts in the tariffs. Winners, losers, people who were friends and versus foes. It seems like, you know, it's the game has sort of changed now that this ruling has come down.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, there's the ruling and what it's going to mean, which maybe let's take a step back and just say that even though the Supreme Court has now ruled that Trump can't use these broad-based emergency powers in the way that he would like, he is still putting tariffs on countries. He's got the, to be a little wonky, the 122 provisions, which allow him to, for 150 days, put tariffs on whoever he likes and in whatever way, which he's doing. He's got the Section 232 rules, which are the national security rules. I expect those to be used a lot more. I think that you're going to see a lot of areas of the economy being talked about in terms of national security. Whether that's the case or not, we can argue. There's also the 301 provisions, and these are provisions that many administrations, including the Biden administration, again, used on China for good reasons. But there are still tools in that tariff toolbox. I think the problem with this administration, and you know, I have often said that Donald Trump and the Donald Trump White House are the wrong answers to the right questions. Did we have a global trading system that was ready for a reboot, that needed to be made fairer, that needed to account for China's development, that needed to account for the fact that high wage labor and environmental concerns are in rich countries are often put to one side and you have a race to the bottom? Yes, we needed all those things to be fixed. Is this the way to do it? No, it's not.
So there were a lot of dire predictions that tariffs would harm growth, would harm prices, would jack prices up. And to my understanding so far, that hasn't, at least it hasn't met the most dire predictions,
right.
Which makes me wonder, are tariffs all that big a deal? Beyond what they signal, right? You talked about the geopolitical dimensions,
yeah.
What they signal to foes, what they signal to friends. But in terms of the dollars and cents impact, do you think today that tariffs are a little less impactful than you might have said a year ago? Do economists think that? Or was this just a question of it didn't have enough time to set in?
So yes, yes, and yes.
Okay, good.
The answer to all those things. Look, tariffs are not one thing, right? If I talk about a tariff on a luxury handbag from France, that's one thing. If I talk about a tariff on a rare earth mineral that you can only get from China, that's another thing. There are so many different kinds of products and impacts. Several reasons you haven't seen a greater price impact and you haven't seen what we thought we were going to see, which is a real spike in inflation. One, going back to the point that I made earlier, big companies, which tend to do most of the trading internationally, have really for 15, 20 years been thinking about how to optimize their supply chains, how to use more technology. AI is helping with that. That was able to mitigate a lot of the headwind, okay? That said, there are also more slow-moving issues. Tariffs depend on how much stockpile do you have in a certain industry. Are you pulling products in right away? That's one of the reasons why you actually did see a bigger price spike on perishables, certain food items, things that you need to bring in every week into a port as opposed to every 6 months or a year. And then, and this is really the most significant thing, it gets lost in a lot of the sort of TikTok debate over all this. We are... By putting these tariffs on, we are saying to the rest of the world, it's game over for the last 50 years and the way things have been done. And the rest of the world is adjusting. It doesn't happen overnight. But I can tell you that countries are cutting new deals with each other. You've seen the EU, which is very concerned about not only the change in the trading paradigm, but the change in America's security posture. They've just cut a big deal with the Latin American consortium to do more free trade. They've cut a big deal with India. So you're seeing the rest of the world align in new ways that, if we don't have smarter policy, will leave America out. And when you have me back on the show in 5 years, believe me, there will be a bigger impact from all that if something doesn't change.
I look forward to that, by the way.
Yeah.
Also, because it means we'll be on the air in 5 years. Just, you know, that's a
that
nice bonus.
That is a good sign.
Yeah.
I hope so. By the way, we'd love to get you, our listeners, your reaction to this tariff ruling. Also, do you think the Supreme Court's break with Trump signals a larger check on presidential power? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Janice says it was good to see the Supreme Court do the right thing for a change. Maida on Facebook says, anytime anyone says no Trump, I'll play that hand. And so, Raina, I wanted to ask you this question. Like, this, we mentioned $200 billion as the amount of money sort of brought in from this. I wonder, what will it have any effect on our bottom line as far as the budget? Because this was supposed to be some revenue, right? There was all these promises made about how much money these tariffs were supposed to make the United States. How does this impact our bottom line as far as the budget is concerned?
Yeah, it's a great question. The U.S. budget is something that a lot of overseas investors in particular are worried about. It's one of the reasons the rising debt and deficit picture in the U.S. is one of the reasons why you've had fewer foreign investors over the last few years buying American Treasury bills. That's kind of a wonky topic, but what that means is if you have fewer people that want to buy your T-bills and invest in dollars, that eventually makes things more expensive for America because the value of our currency goes down and it makes it harder to kind of run the exorbitant budget bills that we do. So yes, in that sense, raising money and trying to throw it onto the deficit was technically a good idea. Now, not all of that money went to driving down debt and deficit. I mean, a lot of it has been spent on other things. And now there's a question about how much of it will have to be paid back, when and how. But Cherry, I want to just address one thing that the listener said about the Supreme Court doing the right thing. It is important, and that actually has, interestingly, an economic impact because one of the things that investors have been very worried about is that the economy in the U.S. is becoming politicized. So to the extent that, international investors see the Supreme Court, which is perceived to be, a Republican-appointed, maybe Republican-biased Supreme Court, to see them saying, well, actually, we think this administration overstepped, that does actually send an interesting note of confidence. So, perhaps we should applaud that.
Wow. Yeah, I guess you could maybe equate it to, the difference in how the markets might react to Trump appointing a board chair that a Fed board chair that people see as
Indeed.
reasonable versus someone who's a pure crony, right? And so,
That's right.
right, it could have the same impact. I want to read this comment from Mary, who says, although I'm pleased with this Supreme Court decision, I think it's purely based on financial provisions. Sadly, if there will be any decision on social issues, I think the court majority will remain in Trump's camp. We've talked about the big picture. Let's get into some of the smaller picture now, Rana, because I'm curious about how businesses now plan for the next few months, the next few years, with all this uncertainty. That's the buzzword right now, uncertainty. You mentioned earlier that, I think you had suggested earlier that larger businesses can absorb this uncertainty better, for various reasons, one of which they might just have like the intellectual firepower to do the research that they need to do the planning,
Definitely.
as opposed to someone who's, their own accountant or whatever.
For sure.
Is that what you think is going to happen here? Like more uncertainty, it might be generally better for the bigger fish than the smaller
Absolutely.
fish. Yeah.
I think this administration in general, despite coming in on a platform that was pretty pro antitrust policy, that was one of the more populist messages that you heard from people like J.D. Vance, for example, saying, yeah, we believe in controlling big corporate monopolies. Actually, no, the record has been pretty spotty in terms of actually breaking up companies or going after those cases since the administration came in. But to your point, a lot of what they're doing is creating uncertainty. It's creating a need for a lot of resiliency, meaning you want to have multiple supply chains, you want to have a lot of stock, you want to be able to really save for a rainy day. That's something that's easier for big companies. And so I think that Trump's economic policy in general will privilege big over small. And I think and I'll make one more point. I think ironically contribute to growing geographic inequality in ways that may come back to bite him politically. Because if you think about where big companies and wealth and power are concentrated, it's mostly on the coast. It's about in 12 places in the country, mostly on the coasts and in a few other urban areas. The red state rural areas and the smaller second cities that this president claims to care about are exactly where businesses are going to be harder hit by these policies.
And Laura brings up the plight of farmers. Farmers have taken such a hit.
Yes.
They've lost markets. They will never recover. If they do, it will be years. That's Laura's thought.
Yeah, very interesting. And it's sort of, to me, it makes me want to piggyback over to voter sentiment because these tariffs are not popular. Voters oppose the president's tariffs by a margin of nearly 2-to-1, 64% to 34%. That's according to a new Washington Post, ABC News, Ipsos poll that came out on Friday. I mean, how do you think all of this is going to land politically as we head into the midterms? And do you think that that will influence, people's sentiment, business sentiment on, how they're viewing this decision and what Trump is his next steps.
It's a great question. Well, I mean, you see the same polls that I do, and it is looking like the Democrats are getting a real tailwind so far in surveys going into the midterms. There are some other issues that I think are interesting. At the same time that you see big tech really being associated with this administration, you see Democrats backing away from AI as people become more concerned about, say, job losses around AI. I think that the risk is really for Republicans right now in the midterms. And I cannot imagine that if we don't get some kind of unexpected boom from a place that I really can't see yet in the job market, that we aren't going to see a real uphill struggle for Trump. I mean, his poll numbers are very low. People don't feel that he's addressed affordability issues. They don't feel that he's done what he said he was going to do coming in. And in fact, they feel that he's just increased instability and volatility in the markets, which is factually true.
And quick follow-up, do you think that this will embolden some Republicans to sort of, you know, take action and say, look, we need to speak up because we're going to get hit really, really hard if we don't?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, I didn't answer that part of your question. Yes, I think that the ICE immigration raids in Minnesota were a big turning point here. The fact that you had a group of, gosh, I think it was a dozen companies, maybe more, that were based in the area coming out and saying, hey, quit this. This is not good for business. This isn't good for social stability. Not to mention the fact that, you know, immigrants work. They're one of the main reasons we haven't had more labor inflation in this country. Knock it off. And, you know, you're seeing other businesses in other states follow suit. You actually saw the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable lauding some of those vocalizations by Minnesota CEOs. And I do think that we're turning a corner. People are now saying publicly what they've been saying privately, really, since Trump won.
Just a minute left, but I want to end on this question from Francis. Will any of this affect prices for consumers who have been paying more for goods because of these tariffs? Again, that word uncertainty floating around, but general trend here, do you think there could be a real impact on prices? We have just a minute left, Rana.
I'm going to say no. Two reasons. One, even if you see a payback of some of those tariffs that were paid by importers, that's going into the pocket of companies, not consumers. Also, inflation is sticky. When prices go up, people get used to them and companies know that, and they tend not to bring them down unless there's something really extreme happening.
Well, I want to say thank you to you, Rana Faruhar, who is the global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times. Fantastic insight this whole hour. Rana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I want to end on this comment from Joe in Soderton, who says the court's decision is a win for American democracy, but it is a little too late. Trump, Congress, and the Supreme Court need to read the Declaration of Independence and U.S. Constitution and do their jobs. Trump's reaction to increased tariffs by other laws indicates he is a spoiled brat having a temper tantrum. That is Joe's comment. Thank you for everyone's comments, by the way, today. Brian and Johnson from Wilmington. And we look forward to hearing more in the shows ahead.
Yes. And got to say thank you to our producers, because we couldn't do this show without them. Thanks so much to Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Charlie Kyer and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia in the blizzard, I'm Cherry Gray.
Stay warm, y'all. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. We'll talk to you tomorrow.